Have you ever dreamed of a life designed by you, not for you? A life where you hold the reins of your financial future? At Become an Investor, we believe in you and your unique potential. We're a community of like-minded individuals all walking the path towards financial independence. We understand that success is crafted in the face of adversity. It's in these testing times that we discover our resilience, our determination, and our discipline. That's why we're inviting you to learn more about Become an Investor. It's not just about learning the ins and outs of real estate investing. It's about empowering you to take control of your financial future. We'll provide the tools, but the choice to act, to persevere, and to succeed is yours. Join us and start your journey towards living life by design. Together, we'll turn aspiration into reality and empowerment into success. Learn more at becomeaninvestor.com.
Hello, everyone. We're back here in the studio again with the full house. I think we haven't had a full house for some time now. What's up,
guys and gals?
Hello.
Hi, beautiful people.
Yeah, where's that energy? Where's that energy, man?
Come on.
Yeah, we're just talking about how to be a chicken or how to be a duck.
Or an egg.
Right, or a fucking egg. Anyway, so this is your Live Life by Design podcast brought to you by Become an Investor. And tonight, no different than other night, picking up a topic and taking it south, right? So
that's what we do.
That's what we do. That's our trademark right there. So we have a quote or
topic.
Topic.
That's
We
have something. We were going to do something.
Oh, the quote first.
Okay. Quote. Sorry. I'm rusty. I wasn't here. You know, my bad. My bad, guys.
So our quote. Topic.
I know, right? No, normally it is the topic, but that's okay. Hey, we're good. Quote of the night. The worst enemy to creativity is self-doubt by Sylvia Plath.
Wow.
The worst enemy to creativity is self-doubt. That's true, man, because, you know, when you start to doubt yourself, nothing fucking works, right?
Yeah, that's a topic in itself.
It is, and I was going to say, man, we should have picked that as the topic because that could have been a good one. Right. But it's so freaking true, right? If you're not confident in yourself, everything just doesn't work, right? Like, if you're just self-doubting, oh, that's not going to work, or, oh, that just fucking failed, nothing works. There's no creativity. Now, it's more wallowing in, how do I get out of this? You go into panic mode, right?
Yeah.
Tell them, you know what? Go away with your negativity and leave me alone. Let me be creative.
But you know what? But it happens, right? Sometimes shit goes sideways for you, and I'm cussing a lot now, excuse me. But stuff goes sideways, and then that does affect your mindset, right?
It does.
And then you start, like, nothing, because, I mean, we were just talking about this. Simple, right? Mm-hmm. Simple tools to use to kind of get yourself out of a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Rock, paper, scissors, right? As simple as that. And then your mind turns on you.
Yeah.
Or you allow it to.
Yeah.
And then nothing works. I mean, this is pretty dope. I like that.
Yeah. Quote. Well, you know what? When I see creativity, it always resonates because I'm creative. And I know we always throw this around about real estate and acquisitions and stuff. That doesn't really wake me up. You know, it's just a tool that I have that I use when it's applicable. But what really drives me is my artistic side. You know, like I operate under my artistic side of the brain. The other one I continuously say it's probably all moldy and shit. You know, it's like under no use whatsoever. I'm not technical. I don't go on that side of the brain. I'm very creative. Everything that I see, everything I live, I go under creativity.
Most creative man I know in a 3-mile radius.
Yeah. Does it help in the real estate industry? Yes, it does. It does very much so, but that does not wake me up. So I'm going to share a little bit about what wakes me up. That creativity that does wake me up and that creativity that I'm good at in with my hands and my art, I know for a fact that I'm creating masterpieces, and self-doubt sometimes does kick in.
Right?
even though I know I fully control the piece I'm working on. And at times, self-doubt kicks in. And it puts my thought process in limbo and it says, God, dude, is this it? Is it leading to the end result that you're looking for?
You know, what's crazy about you saying that, I've seen some of your work. I've seen some of your large-scale work, right? Your Kuiper property.
Yeah.
And for you to say that there's even self-doubt, like if it happened to you, it happens to anybody. And now I'm going to make a whole topic out of this shit here because it's real, right? It doesn't matter how much knowledge you have or how much experience you have or how many deals you did. Self-doubt's still going to come and fucking knock on your door.
It does. It's a very real thing.
If it doesn't, it's because you're not playing with your abilities. You're not growing. That is what I think. You're going, I face self-doubt. Like, when I see that something's bigger, I'm just like, oh, shit. Can I do it? You know, you stop for a minute. Let me put this together. Then you need to sit down, and then you need to, you know, take a minute, take a look on the whole thing, and then you can move forward. At least that is what I do.
Yeah, because sometimes you just unintentionally start to sabotage your own projects, you have the mindset to do things, or you have, you know, you have your plan sketched out, but, you know, it's self-sabotage at the end of the day.
It is. It does. And that's the crazy shit, right? Because if you're not careful with what you put in your mind or allow to come in your mind, gonna fuck you all up. I mean, it's just the reality, right?
Yeah, but you know what? So what initiates that self-sabotage? Is it interior forces or exterior forces?
I think a lot of times it's fear, right?
So what provokes the fear is it, because I know, you know, I can only speak for my artwork. I know I'm a badass at what I do.
Right.
Right. I know I am people's idol in my industry, and I'm gonna just be black and white about this. That self-sabotage doesn't come from within because I know who I am. Sometimes I get caught up in the opinions of others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it is. But I still think that's internal, because there's a level of insecurity that is allowing you to let that hit you, because all of us operate under a level of
so pleasing, pleasing people.
Not necessarily even pleasing, but the acceptance part. Maybe you're looking for that acceptance from them, and then when they tell you no or this or that, it's an internal, because you can easily turn it off and say "fuck you." I don't care about what you have to say. But then in certain cases, maybe somebody, I don't know. Maybe it's just maybe it's the fucking subconscious that you don't want to be criticized
or something.
Well, taking it back to what Daniela was saying, I think also, you know, when you put the project into perspective, or when you put the idea into perspective, you see it at a greater scale, right? Than when you first, I'm going to buy this property, such and such like this. But then when you get into the project and you actually see the magnitude, or you see all the steps that need to be completed, that's where I'm thinking the self-sabotage starts. Like, okay, can I do this? What
the hell did I get myself into?
Yeah, can I do this? Yeah. You know, is this within my skill set? You know, do I have the right people to help me? Who do I need to reach out to? So that's kind of like, I was kind of going off of where.
Everything legal.
So that always get on me. It was just like, wait, everything legal.
Yeah, I mean, it's a number of different things, right?
Yeah.
The overwhelming feeling, right, to your point.
The overthinking
part of the overwhelming.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I've been trying to shut that side up. You and I talked a little bit about a business that I'm looking to go active in. And I didn't think about anything other than do the research and take action.
Mm-hmm.
And then I talked to you, and then you kind of slowed me down a little bit, which very well should have, right? I was going to make a big investment, and it's like, hey, well, why don't you try X, Y, and Z first before you make that big investment? And I'm like, you know what? I didn't think of that. Good point. Mm-hmm. So does that stop me? No.
It shouldn't.
No. But does it create any self-doubt? No, but a little bit it did. I get set. What it did was gave me a speed bump for a second in my mind. But you didn't do anything to create that. It just, when I heard that, I was like, oh, shit. You know, I put it, I let it come into my head out of something that had nothing to do with our conversation.
Right.
So I think that it's, like I said, maybe a level of insecurity at some point that, that allows us to just kind of, like, I'm not stopping on this business. I think it's a great idea. No,
and you shouldn't. And you shouldn't.
But it was just like for a second, fuck, wait a minute. Maybe I'm going too fast here. You know what I mean? And then when I started saying, okay, maybe I'm going too fast. And then I got, you know, I did what I said I was going to do, got the machines and everything. And then I tried it and I was like, well, fuck. Like, I felt like there's no, like, I let the push go.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
My own push to say, get it done. And, oh, and by the way, I cut my fucking hands up. And then I was thinking about it over the weekend after, like, you know, the next 2 days. And I was like, you know, you made a good point to me, and I'm fucking myself in my own thoughts.
Yeah. But now look at the other side of that. So I gave you my 2 cents,
mm-hmm.
right, which might have been that speed bump. But then if whatever I proposed gives you an upside to the results that you were expecting, maybe better results, maybe your investment, you'll just say, hell, I'll double down on this.
Right.
You and know?
That's a good point. Because when I was talking to my son about that, and he was like, you know what? I thought that was a good, you know, we both agreed what you said was a good idea. And I was thinking like exactly that. And you know what? When we utilize something else and get good at this,
mm-hmm.
exactly that, we could double down because now we both have that experience for a lot less money, right? We can bank some of that into the investment.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So yeah,
absolutely.
It was a good idea.
You know, like for me, I'm old school kind of deal. But I kind of like enjoy that because, you know, first and foremost, I know what I'm doing. And then I get back into an industry that I've touched on. I start off where I left off.
Yeah.
I don't start off from zero, which starting from zero is very complicated. And that's where people quit, you know. But when you go back into an industry and start off where you left off when you left it, it's easy. You know, like I utilize all these tools to, you know, if I need to generate, if I need to create working capital, say 200, 300, 400 grand, I know where to go, you know.
Yeah.
For whatever project I'm looking, not applicable to real estate, anything that I'm doing, if you want to generate some working capital and you have the tools, why not use the tools?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So like the experience that you can share from having the experience, somebody starting off something and maybe not having the experience, well, why don't you not do what I did that got me in trouble?
Exactly.
You know? That's so it was like a little bit of coaching
100%
kind of deal.
100%.
And that allows you to see that as a speed bump and say, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I could have drained all my capital into this and maybe the results weren't gonna match the expectation.
The expectation, exactly.
And then I fall out of love and then I can just say, oh, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Where maybe it was just a broader learning curve.
And that's exactly how I take that.
Right? Yeah. And you know, it's like experience never expires, right?
Nope.
So if you could get something free from that could save you a headache, a heartache, or a wallet ache, you know, dude, that's like gold.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I think that leads into our topic that we're trying to get to for the last hour or so.
Yes.
Which is, so to see Sarah's face right now.
Yeah.
I mean, they're talking, Daniela, they're talking in code about the business that he started. So
I'm about to just, you know, get out and just leave.
Yeah.
Live the princess talking.
I told you this whole bad is the topic in itself. You
know,
badass.
But, you know, it leads right into the possibilities, pro and con, about real estate, right? Yeah. Everybody's so quick and so fancy and so sexy about talking about so many different strategies and topics. I think like the word strategy gets tossed around like a, I don't know, man, like a
hot potato.
Yeah, like a hot potato. And it seems to be like a selling point nowadays in the world of real estate investing. And people see strategy and then they say, oh my God, that's the next moneymaker. It's complete bullshit, man.
Like with the whole burr.
Yeah, it's just BS. Strategies, they're a dime a dozen. There's so many different strategies that you can come across in the world of real estate investing. But if you don't know what the hell you're doing, you're going to eat shit, man.
Yep.
You know, that's just plain 101. But nevertheless, we should still talk about some of them. And they can get you in trouble. They can make you a lot of money, and then they can get you in trouble, right?
Oh, yeah.
So why don't we just start right off the bat, number one on the list,
seller
financing. Sarah.
Seller financing. So this is one of the most heard of, I would say. This is one that's been thrown out there a lot. So seller financing is the seller finances the purchase, allowing the buyer to make installments directly to the seller. So it's often with agreed upon interest. So the seller is your bank, right?
Yep. And I've used this strategy of seller financing a couple of times. But everything has to be worked out, agreed upon, written contractually, right? And you got to be careful that they're already kind of, like a lot of times, at least in my experience where I was able to make it work, is they're already kind of in trouble anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm just utilizing their situation to help get them out of the situation.
Yeah.
Right. But then also make a profit.
Right. So, you know, in the seller financing, because it's a creative strategy, what makes it creative? Nothing makes it fucking creative, really. Other than, you know, you thinking you have a creative strategy because somebody is in dire need of getting out of the hole.
Yep.
And to do that, they got to sell their property and they're going to paint it like a pig, even though it's still a pig, and tell you, you know what, I'm going to finance it for you. But then what happens if you don't do your due diligence? What happens when they recoup their job? They recoup their pay that allowed them to keep that mortgage. If you don't look at the small lines or delete, you know, like just put out all these terms in all the fine print, right?
Right.
You're so anxious to get your deal and you miss out on the terms. What happens when the seller says, you know what? I don't need you anymore, man.
Yeah, give me my house back.
Yeah, give me my fucking house back.
And by the way, thanks for the money.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, pros and cons. You have to be very diligent about all these different steps.
Yep.
You have to know what you're doing. And if you don't know what you're doing, then go to somebody that knows what they're doing.
Right. And that's the thing, though, across the board, right? Any one of these strategies that we talk about or just any deal that you come across, you got to make sure you do your due diligence and make sure that you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's.
Yeah. Well, you know what? One of the biggest mistakes we're going to talk about as soon as we, you know, as fast as we can, just lightly touching on them. We have 20 on the list. We might not get to the 20, but I will tell you just a piece of advice. Don't be that one investor that learns one strategy and wants to apply that strategy to every fucking deal you come across. You want to force a strategy in every single deal you come across. You're just going to be a mediator. That's it. You're not going to be a full-grown, well-rounded up investor. You're just going to be a mediator because you only know how to apply one of the tools in one of the sections, and then the other missing component somebody else is going to have to bring to the table. So you're going to have to be a good connector, point. What they call, right? Like the connectors, you know?
Yeah.
Well, why do I have to connect you to somebody else with my lead? Well, because you don't have the tools.
Wholesaler.
So I got to connect you to the people that do.
Wholesaler.
Anyways, I'm getting pissed off. Anyways, number two, lease options. Danny.
Lease options. Pretty simple. It says everything there, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, they can't see it.
Leave me alone. lease option. Buyer lease the property was an option to purchase that later. Typically securing a portion of the rent paid towards eventual purchase price.
Right.
Friedman, did you understand everything that I read?
Yeah, so we understand you. Anybody want to add to that?
I've never worked this strategy before.
Okay.
Lease option has not been something that I've practiced. But it sounds, I mean, it seems pretty straightforward, right? Where the buyer leases the property.
Right.
And it gives you an option to buy.
Yeah. So, I mean, say they lease the property for a year or 2 years or 3 years or 10 years, whatever the terms are. And then after the 10th year, if that's the case, or the first year, whatever it is, then you have the right to exercise within a period of time, right? Somebody says, I'm going to lease you the property for a year. And then 90 days thereafter, you have a decision to make if you want to exercise your option. Or continue renting the property. I don't mind a great tenant in place, especially if you've been there taking care of my property for a year.
And paying.
And paying on time, right?
Yeah.
But then if you decide to not exercise your option, then you can remain a tenant.
Yep.
Right? Or remain exercise your option to buy based on the terms we agreed on once the contract was drafted. So it could get... These could get a little sensitive with an uprise of the market or a downfall of the market.
Yep.
You know, these are applicable. They could be comfortably applicable to a steady market, you know. But, I mean.
I did that before. In good phase, I was just like, all right, let me give you, I think it was $3,000 on upfront, right? And if you decide not to do anything, you keep it. Like a deposit or something like that, but
yeah,
that was just in a good phase.
Yeah, so that sounds more like an option instead of the lease. You know, when you purchase an option, say for instance, I'm gonna you want to buy my laptop, and then I tell you my laptop is worth $10,000, and then you say I'm gonna give you $1,000, and then I have first option to buy within a year, and then I have to honor that option to you for your $1,000. And then when that year expires or soon to expire, you say, okay, I wanna exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? And Danielle is getting educated here, galera.
No, but you know,
it is true. It is true.
That's why it's important to have clarity in all these different steps, because even though they're very similar, there's different intentions with them at the end. You know? Subject to compost.
That's where the buyer acquires the property subject to the existing mortgage. Excuse me. Taking over the seller's mortgage payments without formally assuming the loan. What does that mean? That means you have a loan in place. And a lot of times, I mean, we deal with this. We actually do a lot of these types of deals where we'll get the loan caught up where it needs to be because of if they're in pre-foreclosure and take possession of the property. Subject to that mortgage, meaning basically kind of in layman's terms, I'm taking over payments.
Right.
Without ever having to apply for that mortgage loan or anything like that. I know this strategy has been around like forever, right?
Oh, yeah.
I think, though, that it's just been getting a lot of attention maybe over the last year or so.
Yep.
Maybe the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And, again, you know, one of those hot topic button, you know, words. Sub two, right?
Yeah.
That where, you know, everybody thinks it's something new, but no, this is something, I mean, I haven't been around the game that long, but it's been about 4 years. And I remember, you know, when I first got into this, I was like, what is subject two? And then, oh shit, that's pretty cool. So I know it's been around for a while. It's that's just been like really heavily marketed now, it seems like, but it's a great strategy. Very, very easy, particularly if you have shitty credit. You can help somebody who's losing their house with no credit, right?
Yeah, so I learned this strategy back in, I want to say 1999 when I bought my first real estate course from Carlton Sheets. Carlton Sheets. It was still cassettes and then upgraded to the CDs. So I did an upgrade. and it was your late night, you know, midnight infomercial. And I don't think he's around anymore, but, you know, he used to talk about all these all the time. You know, subject to, well, what the hell is subject to? I didn't understand them back then, but I still have my books actually, and I know that they were, you know, that prehistoric.
That's 25 years ago. Yeah, quarter of a century.
Yeah, but you know, so on our list we have subject 2 as number 3, and then if you look down to number 9, that's assuming a mortgage. I'm going to touch on assuming a mortgage because there's a misconception of subject 2 and assuming a mortgage. This is typically misunderstood by people not in real estate or people trying to get into real estate. So assuming a mortgage, you have to fully qualify to take over that mortgage. You can't just take over the mortgage. Assuming the mortgage, like I would never apply to assume a mortgage. Why? Because I have no credit. But I'll buy a subject to property every day because I don't need my credit.
Yeah.
Right? So in a subject to property, you take legal ownership of the property, but not legal liability of the debt. Right? Debt stays in place, and then your name goes on title. Right? And in assuming a mortgage, you take direct liability of that debt. And you have to be qualified to do so. Not just wake up and say,
because there is no real subject to in the mobile home industry or mobile home realm, if
okay.
you will.
Okay.
So anything would have to be more of a assumable mortgage. Yeah.
Yeah. So I can see where people misconnect both, right? Or confuse both.
Yeah, I mean, they're so close in proximity, right?
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at it at a high level, not fully understanding, you can see how people can get confused over it. But, yeah, two completely different things.
Two very completely different things.
Yeah, because you have to qualify for that loan at the end of the day.
Right, right. Okay, so moving forward, wraparound mortgage. Sarah.
So the wraparound mortgage is a new mortgage that wraps around the existing mortgage, allowing the buyer to make one combined payment, often to a third party or directly to the seller.
I've never done a wraparound mortgage.
Never heard about it. Never done one.
I've heard about them, but to me, they're too convoluted, you know, with so many different steps. I don't know. I'm just ignorant to it. I've never done a wraparound. No comment.
Yeah, it just sounds a new mortgage that wraps around the existing. Hey, anyway, I don't see benefit in
that. That sounds like a lot,
right? I don't know. I want to look into that a little further, but it doesn't. On the surface, it doesn't seem beneficial.
So it is. It is. It could be. Again, when you buy a wrap, it could be in that sense where you don't have credit or qualifying credit, right? But I don't want to go further. I'm not fully educated in wraparound mortgages, and I don't want to talk out of my ears. Anyways, contract for deed. Who wants to touch on that one?
I will. The buyer takes possession of the property and makes payments directly to the seller, while the seller retains the title until the contract is fulfilled.
Yes.
Contract for deed.
Contract for deed. That's one of my exit strategies. Offloading strategies.
Well, there you go.
So it's cool. You essentially become the bank, right? So say I have 123 Main Street and you're interested in my property. My mentor, his strategy was the following. Sarah is interested in 123 Main Street and Steve is interested in 123 Main Street. Steve has a top performing credit score and Sarah does not. Sarah has a down payment and so does Campos. Who do I side?
Guy with a good credit.
No, you side the individual with the bad credit. Okay, because the individual, this is what he does, okay? I'm not saying this is what I do. But again, contract for deed strategies are better applied to buyers that cannot qualify on your regular, you know, conventional terms. Mm-hmm. So now I know that Sarah has poor credit. She's high risk, right? Very difficult for her to get a mortgage. So now what I'm going to do, I'm going to say, Steve, thank you for applying very much. Man, you have a great day. But I decided to go with Sarah because she's a higher risk, meaning the possibilities of me foreclosing on her are higher than that of doing it on you. So now I take $25,000 down payment on you because you have good credit. Maybe your payment's going to be $1,000 just for the sake of the conversation. But then Sarah's could be $1,500 because she knows that she doesn't have the credit. And there has to be some, you know, some skin in the game.
Yeah.
So she's got to pay the price of not maintaining that good credit either today or tomorrow. It happens to be that she wants to apply it to 123 Main Street. And now she's got to pay $500 more than you that took care of your credit. Now, because she has a track record of not being too careful with her credit, the risk factor of her not coming through with her payments goes sky high, which means I can foreclose on you, kick you out.
Keep all the money that she paid you.
Keep all the money that you paid me.
And then sell it all over again.
And then go look for Danny. Maybe she's another scenario where her credit's not as good. And even though Steve comes back and says, dude, I could have kept that house, la, la, la. I had perfect credit. I had the down payment. I was qualified, blah, blah, blah. All that good shit that anybody, any mortgage company would want to hear is not what I want to hear because that's not my exit.
Yep.
It's a little, it could get a little shiesty. It could get a little predatorious. As a matter of fact, there is a term that used to be thrown around in California, and I think it's actually illegal now, even to promote, which is rent to own. Mm. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, don't quote me on that. I think it's illegal because it's deemed predatory. Is the intention of the seller is that carrot.
Yeah. The big interest rate associated with it it's kind of being predatory to the people with bad credit, knowing that they're not going to pay their bills.
Right.
So now, I mean, and that was a big thing. Anyway, I don't want to get all down that road, but it was a big thing before.
But that's contract for deed. If done right, if done well, you can help people and make a ton of money doing it too.
Yeah, I caught on to this through Robert Kiyosaki. He talked about this quite a bit before.
Contract for deed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he called it something. I can't remember what he called it, but that was a strategy that he talked about in one of his books.
It's a great strategy. I mean, actually, things are changing for me and my business here in California. Contract for deed was my exit. That was my exit. I figured, okay, if I can have my properties just, if I can be the bank to the properties and then collect, you know, down payments and do my mortgage payments, you know, juicy enough, right, for me to be incentivized to do so, I could retire, man, right? I could have all this cash flow coming in and then still be the bank for 30 years. Hmm. Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just on the surface, but you can go deeper in it. And then all of a sudden now California doesn't want you to be, I mean, they're doing so many red flags on processes to buy more homes. Right. And,
yeah.
and all that shit, taxes and all these.
Yeah. It's getting crazy.
Whatever.
This podcast is sponsored by Become an Investor. Here at Become an Investor, we believe in you and your unique potential. We're a community of like-minded individuals, all working a path towards financial independence. We're about empowering you to take control of your financial future. Well, how? Well, most of us got started with foreclosure leads, and you now can too. Follow the link in the show notes below, and for a limited time, you can get our foreclosure ebook. With that, we'll also send you up to 10 free leads in your local area. So get those leads. Get this book so you too can get started on your path to living life by design. Now back to the podcast.
Number six, partnerships and joint ventures. Danny.
It is what it is. Let's partner it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Partner with someone and, you know, another investor group where one part provided the capital and the other one provide the expertise like with you here and management. So if you're going to put together A and B, make that a good deal.
Yeah.
Make sure you guys are doing that under a good contract. So
right.
Black and white.
That's the key word, the contract.
Yeah.
Anybody want to expand on that one? Don't push each other, please. You're going to break the mic.
Sorry, I was thinking about, I mean, no, I mean, it's pretty straightforward, right? In fact, I don't know if that's real creative or not. Maybe I'm wrong, but
very creative.
Partnerships and joint venture, that's pretty, well maybe, I guess, maybe because it's common to me, right? Because I've partnered with people and leveraged their, in some cases, their expertise, right? But I mean, yeah. But that's just, well, I don't know, maybe that's just common sense. I don't know, like.
Well, no, I remember one time, which applies to another one of these, I became a partner to a firm that I was flipping so many houses for that when I saw no more incentive in that track, they brought me in as a partner. Mm. So I'm like, what? You want me as a partner? I'm like, yeah. You know, it's more feasible for us to give you a partnership in this than see you go. Why? Because I was doing everything they didn't want to do, taking pictures in the beach, having margaritas, and doing all their good shit, and I pretty much held the fort. So partnerships are very important, depending on what scale you're looking at them.
Well, I didn't say not important, yeah. But not very creative is what I'm getting at, because I don't see, I don't know, again, maybe so I'm they looking got at it from creative. A different lens. They did.
So creativity doesn't always have to come from us. It could also come from your opportunity, right? So for people listening that are looking to get into real estate investing, you know, maybe you don't understand joint ventures, right? Maybe that's a term, not an everyday term, but partnerships is an everyday term applicable to many different aspects in life. And in real estate, it could be just as easy as, hey, you know what? I know somebody that knows somebody that wants to sell a house. And if you want that address, we always talk about 123 Main Street. But I'm just going to tell you 1-2. I'm not going to give you the third number. Main Street. It might be a deal, right? Yeah. I'll partner with you on it. You know, I mean, there's so many possibilities in partnering, not knowing what you don't think you know. You know?
Right. Well, my biggest thing about partnerships is two big deals for that. Number one, it cuts my risk in half. Right. That's one thing. Number two.
Oh, yeah.
It relieves or it eases, loosens capital 50% as well.
Right.
So that's why to me, partnerships are just kind of a thing I do, right, for the most part.
Of course.
Because it just makes sense to me. Maybe, you know, I'm just looking at it from that lens of it's just a common thing to me.
Yeah, right? Yeah, of course. That allows you to do more.
Exactly. Right?
Allows you to do much more. Equity sharing, Sarah?
So equity sharing is an arrangement when you purchase a property and then share ownership, profits, and cost with another party, typically in exchange for a reduced initial cost of risk. So yeah, equity sharing is not just profit, but it's everything else that comes with it.
Right. Yes. Go ahead.
I was going to say that's a strategy I haven't used, but one of my partners and I were kind of going down that road with the property where we proposed that to the seller, right? And they were digging it, you know, because mm-hmm. there was no risk on their part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just a distressed property, right?
Yeah.
Needed a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
We were willing to put up the funds to make the work happen. Now, besides our costs, anything outside of that, you know, profit, equity out of the property, we were going to split.
Yeah.
Which was kind of cool. Yeah. Minus our costs, of course.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the deal didn't go through. So, otherwise, I'd say, hey, I use this strategy. But no, we didn't make it happen, unfortunately. But it seemed like it still was a win-win. It was a good way of approaching that particular situation, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. In a small scale, equity sharing would be the, I guess the term for it in a larger scale, they call it fractional ownership, you know, where you buy into a bigger investment with the fraction of the investment to own fraction of the ownership. In equity sharing, it's like you said, it's a divided, like a division of interest in the forefront or risks in the forefront and then interest in the back end, right?
Yep. Uh-oh. Everybody's... Hey, everybody's getting the cough attack. I think I gave it to everyone, man. That sucks. All right, well, they're coughing.
Oh,
let's,
my God.
Let's move on to the next one.
Fucking equity got stuck right there, man.
Right? Seller carryback. The seller carry is a second mortgage allowing the buyer to obtain primary financing and the seller to finance part of the purchase price. Okay. Any comments on that one, guys?
I'm dying.
Oh, you should drink something, dude. Drink something. You all right?
Yeah, I'm good.
You remember when, you know, the baby coughs, you're supposed to blow in their face? I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just saying. Oh, shit. So the seller carries a second mortgage allowing the buyer to obtain primary. I'm not real familiar with it. I've heard this term before, but I haven't practiced or utilized it at all. But allowing the buyer to obtain the primary financing and the seller to finance part of the purchase price is actually, I mean, it helps, right? I think it's there is some creativity there. But, you know, it's one of those deals you got to work, right?
Yeah, something... Right. Something fairly new here, because we haven't used it, right?
Yeah, well, Weecho probably has at some point, but
I'm sure
he's drowning in his cough right now.
And I think we talked about assumable mortgage.
We did.
And then we talked about option contracts.
Yeah.
So the next one would be the hard money loans.
Short-term high-interest loans based on the property's value rather than the borrower's credit worthiness.
It's still, they will ask for some... When you do the hard money loans, they're still going to ask for some. How do you say that?
The credit worthiness?
No, not really.
Some experience behind what you're doing. Yeah, they want to see that you've closed at least a couple of deals, or at least five or six.
Nobody wants to just lose everything.
Right.
Right.
They want to see a little mini portfolio to back up the loan that you're going to ask for, right?
Usually HUD statements and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm. So following is private money lending. So borrowing funds from private individuals or groups, often under more flexible terms than traditional lenders. So those are two different ones, right?
Yeah.
Very different. So the private one is you can borrow from a friend, from your dad, your mom.
Your cousin, your uncle.
Right, yeah.
but again, different from traditional terms. So they're not looking for, a lot of times they're not going to be looking for credit. They're not going to be looking for maybe not necessarily even income in some cases, depending on what your relationship is with that private lender, right?
Right. More lenient.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. The next one is trading or bartering, exchanging other assets or services for the property or as part of the down payment.
I'm going to say right there, that sounds like a Weecho special right there, man.
Yeah, I'm back, guys. I was choking. It's crazy. I have this stupid little cough that comes every now and then. I was telling Bruce, I feel something in here like, I think I'm growing a fucking hair behind my tongue or something. Because it's always like itchy right there. And I feel like I want to scratch it. Like cough the hell out. Shit. Anyways, yeah. You guys were talking about
private lending, but we got into trading and bartering. And trading or bartering. And I said, that's a Weecho special right there, man. That's kind of right up your alley.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. That's a game changer for me. You know? And it could be for anybody. That's an open door for anybody that is willing to go the extra mile, right? That is willing to do extra things for the team all the time. And, you know, I just shared that in that firm that I used to run the flips for, I pretty much traded and bartered my experience doing exactly what they needed in exchange for a position in the firm.
Nice.
You know, I've bartered so many different things and traded so many different things in the past, and it's never done me wrong. It's never done me wrong. And what's cool about it, it very cheap way to acquire big things.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Oh, it's invaluable. So next one, assume tenants in common. Danny?
Co-owning property with multiple parties, each holding a separate and undivided interest.
Yeah. So that one, I mean, that's the first time I see this specific strategy. I don't know if it's named a different way, but I spoke about fractional ownership and then equity splitting or equity sharing. It sounds co-owning a property with multiple parties. It sounds like, you know, you own a fraction of something. Is that more applicable to multifamily?
Multifamily, probably, yeah.
Like a house hacking kind of deal? No.
No, I think multifamily would be something that you would say, because that is when you're co-owning the property with a lot of people, right? It's never, I would say, nobody, just one person. I mean, it depends on the doors, how many doors they're going to own one property. But usually there is the shareholders, there is, you know, there is the JVs involved, the JPs, and everything else. So it's the interest, right? It's not, that is what you do on the multifamily, pretty much, not exactly on single family homes.
Yeah, I don't see masses of asses owning a house. Yeah, one house.
There's just not a lot of meat on that bone, right?
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense for, at least I know for my end, having, you know, I'm okay with one partner, maybe two partners on the property, depending on how many properties currently working on.
Right.
But even if I only had that one property, I would say tops two partners, you know, top of the top, just two partners. More than that, you know, it's like, I think the headache would be more than the benefit, right? Especially if it's long term
that way,
you know.
Yeah. And need to know is who you're marrying over there, right?
Yeah. Let's
move on to the next one.
Let's move on. Foreclosure or pre-foreclosures,
buying out of foreclosure or pre-foreclosure, purchasing properties from owners in financial distress either before or during the foreclosure process. We kind of touched on that during when we talked about the subject too, right? Yeah. You know, it's just a matter of making the loan whole, if you will, and then utilizing a strategy to acquire the property from the homeowner at the end of the day, right?
Right. So, you know, the foreclosure, pre-foreclosure is a circumstance. The vast majority of the others on the list, that's a circumstance. The other ones are options. The other ones are decisions to make what mostly fits, because not every pre-foreclosure is a subject to.
Yeah.
Right. And not every subject to is a pre-foreclosure.
Exactly.
Right. Yep. So pre-foreclosure is something that they lost, or foreclosure they lost grip of. Now they have to go on to this list and select what best fits their exit, right? And then go from there. But, you know, I love pre-foreclosures.
Yes, sir.
They're top of my list.
Yeah.
You know, top of my list.
It's spread over there to negotiate.
Yeah. Time. But, yeah. So, buying at auction. Sarah.
So buying at auction is acquiring properties through public auctions, often at lower than market prices, while being aware of the risks and due diligence required.
Yeah. Expand on that, Campos?
Yeah. So, you know what? I've been working on this with a couple of mobile homes, buying at auction. So it's a different experience, you know, versus, you know, talking to the homeowner up front. what I was doing initially was, instead of having to take it to auction, is actually contacting or skip tracing and finding the next of kin, because the couples that I did kind of work on buying at auction were because somebody passed away, right? And the property was sitting there. The next of kin didn't pay any of the rent space and so on and so forth. So, you know, we went to auction. But
what I ended up doing was trying to get rid of the auction and just going directly to the next of kin and trying to offer them something to sign the title over. That's, I mean, just another strategy in itself, right? But buying at auction, there's ways to, that you're not really able to inspect the property, things of that sort. But, you know, with mobile homes, I kind of find a way. Ask, I think the last one you can ask Anita about, which is actually kind of funny.
Yeah.
One of our students.
Yeah. So buying at auction, you get what you pay for. You know, if the house is full of squatters, they're yours.
Yep.
Now you have to go through the eviction process, at least here in California, right? Redemption periods are also something you have to have within your knowledge base and your radar. You know, what's the redemption period for whatever type of auction it is? If it's a tax lien, how many days or months does the original owner have to make that tax defaulted amount whole and have right to the property again? You know, and it varies in different states and different counties. So you have to be very, very aware of your due diligence when you're going through this process, because you don't want to buy into a property that has a redemption period of, say, 6 months, and then you rehab the property in 3 months, and then they take it back fully renovated. You know, it's like now you're in a civil bind because you want your money back.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, so very diligent about that. I'm not going to talk about retirement funds because I don't plan to retire, but who wants to take on that?
I don't plan on retiring either, so I'm going to pass on that one too.
Okay. Danny, using retirement funds.
Self-directed. I mean, that is what had a little 401. I think he used that on which property it was. I think it was in Japan property. Mm-hmm. So that is what you did, self-directed, and you move money here and there.
Yeah.
And then boom, you have a little extra to play.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's not, you're going to just, it's a strategy that you're looking to make more, because whatever they put on there, and when it's on the account, it's really low. You don't really make too much mm-hmm. money back. A lot of people use that, but more for funds, not, I mean, you can fund a property. It depends on your retirement. I mean, not legal advice again.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. it's the strategies that you can use for that, or, you know, lend the money or lend your own project. You can use, short term to lend to your own project. Maybe you have a flip. You can also do that, mm-hmm. return the money, and go from there.
Yeah. Yeah.
3 months.
Self-directed 401ks and IRAs are awesome for those that have them. I don't have one, honestly, and I don't plan to retire because I live in retirement, if you know what I'm saying.
Live life by design.
Right? Live life by design. But yeah, go to your accountant, go to your attorney, your tax attorney, and if you have a IRA or 401k through your employer, you want to look into what it takes to be the custodian of them, and self-direct them, turn them into a Roth, to where your accounts can invest money and exponentially grow your retirement account.
Right.
No legal counsel.
And on the flip side of that, though, they also take that loan, right? It's kind of a loan, right? And then mm-hmm. they pay back the interest to themselves as well, right?
I don't have one.
Yeah, I think that's.
Well, there's
no legal advice or accounting advice.
Yeah, no. Yeah,
there's time and things that you need to pay attention to, taking out and putting back on the account. So
yeah, I took a whole course on self-directed IRAs and 401ks, and talked about the prohibited transactions and non-prohibited transactions and all that good stuff. But because I don't have one, it's not applicable. but what is good for you to know, if this could be your golden nugget tonight, is that if you are looking to get into real estate investing and you know someone that has a self-directed IRA or 401k, or not yet, and you could, just plant the seed for them to maybe seek legal counsel and be able to get the most and best out of it to exponentially grow their account for retirement, they could become your private lenders.
Right.
Private money sources.
Yeah.
But anyways, moving on. Joint ventures with developers. Campos, you want to touch on that one?
Yes, sir. I kind of lost my space there, my place. Partner with developers who need capital or land for their project, securing a portion of the profits or return on investment. I can't even talk now. I lose my cough, give it to you, and now I'm the one I can't talk.
Yeah. So partnering with developers is a good thing. Contractors is a good thing. You know, one of the most expensive tickets on flipping homes is the actual flip, right? So when you connect with the contractor that has great, you know, like a great workforce, a great platform of resources, great prices on goods and all that stuff, at wholesale pricing, it could give you an incredible, incredible advantage to acquiring properties, you know. And if you can leverage that and the contractor can wait till the end, so there's no holding costs on the rehab. Say if you have a $100,000, $150,000, $80,000 rehab going on, and you don't have the funding for it, or you're having troubles finding the gap or the funding for the rehab, your contractor can maybe float it, you know, and fund it, get it across the finish line and wait to get paid at the end, or just sit on it for equity sharing, fractional ownership.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
You know,
go back to some of those
all these are inner
strategies that we were talking about. Yeah,
you know, it just depends on you know, a lot of people get locked in and utilize them as an acquisition side because they're getting into the business. Well, no, you also apply them on the exit, on the selling side. These have two sides, you know. You can buy a property as a wholesale and then wholesale it, right? But then people don't, you know, they because they're coming into the business, they're understanding how to get in, not how to get out. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So these strategies, they don't see them applied at the end. Moving forward, short sales. I hate them. I want to talk about them.
Negotiating with lenders to purchase a property for less than what's owed on the mortgage, typically with the lender's approval.
There's nothing short about short sale. That's the reality.
Yeah.
Lots of paperwork, lots of days.
Lots of waiting, right?
Yes.
So waiting, Sarah, and a chance for no.
as a TC, did you have a chance to work with a lot of short sales?
We did. We had to use an app. I remember it was called, it was software called Equator, and everything had to be submitted through there.
Yeah.
You had to scan everything through there, and it was a lot of back and forth. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it took forever and a day, and it was just a lot of paperwork and a lot of waiting. And it was very specific. They wanted things a certain way, so it was very, very,
and every then, page.
Very, yeah, very specific ways to.
And then some not to get approved, right?
Oh yeah, they'd come back and I'm sorry, you know, you missed this, or and it was like simple things, but I mean, you're dealing with the bank at this point, so
yeah,
they call the shots pretty much.
But I think the biggest thing though is the seller. And how they show their insolvency, right? And not being able to pay that loan anymore. And I think that's one of the biggest things that people don't necessarily think about, but that's a big part of it, right?
Yeah, it is. But then, like I said, at the end of the day, it's the bank that will factor everything mm-hmm. into their equation and then just let you know after 35 days, 40 days, you're missing one more piece of evidence. Yeah. And you submit that, and it's still, like, it takes forever. So, but, yeah, that does play a big factor.
Yeah, and then the non-arms, non-legs, transactions.
All that.
All that BS, you know. You don't want to say that you can't pay the mortgage and then you sell it to your cousin. You know. So, yeah, it's for me, it didn't make the waiting. And then once approved, they don't approve you for a loan. They want their big fat check for whatever they, you know, agreed on. Not me. I hate short sales. Crowdfunding. Danny.
Yeah. Pulling resources for multiple investors through online platforms to acquire real estate, sharing ownership and profits. Its strategies comes with its own set of legal, financial, and operational consideration, and it is crucial to conduct a true due diligence and consult with professionals such as real estate attorneys and financial advisors to ensure the chosen method aligns with your investments, goals, and risk tolerance. Crowdfunding usually it's used for bigger projects because you need more people. I mean, it's like I said, just like a bigger project needs more money,
right?
Bigger development. Also see a lot of that on multifamily and development, right? And a lot of legal advice needs there once you start doing that, because you might take other people with you, you know, when you're funding the money. So, yeah, you need to consult probably an attorney.
Oh, yeah.
And go from there.
Yeah.
The risk, it's bigger, you know. Just make sure you know all your numbers and you're doing your homework when you're getting engaged in a project using crowdfunding, or if you were raising capital through that way. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the biggest fuck up here in crowdfunding is the humans, but you know, the humans that don't have clarity in their investment goals and their risk tolerance.
Yeah,
some people don't even know their risk tolerance. You know why? Because they've never had to be put in that space to understand what that risk feels like, so they can't tolerate what they don't know. So their investment goals, you know, they have clarity, or they think they have an idea of what their investment goals are. But then when you crowdfund and you get into a pool of people where you have no control and sometimes no say, you feel like you're at a loss. It sucks, right? It sucks because you want to know a specific answer to your money.
Yeah.
But they only have answers to the money of the project. They're not going to say, oh, Mr. Campos, your $500 that you put in are going to do this and this. No, they're going to give you a schematic of what that is. And then you're going to do your math and say, well, my $500 only is bringing $5 in.
Yeah, you know? For real.
And then you're going to say, well, shit, I let go of $500. But you don't understand your risk tolerance because of $5. I mean, now you are. You're going to say, what, $5 is coming back over $500? I would have never done this. That means your risk tolerance isn't there. Right, it's not meeting your investment goals.
Right.
So for crowdfunding, it, like Danny said, it's for bigger projects, that maybe one person couldn't fund themselves. Right. Mm-hmm. Some people want to park their money somewhere, and you know, just.
And there's a bunch of crowdfundings, right? Sometimes it's big acquisitions, multifamily, for example, they do that for the acquisition part so they can get paid.
Yeah,
you know, just know for or how you're going to use that.
Yeah,
it might be a bigger project, and if you want your $5 back, I mean, a little faster, know how you're going to know your expectations on that deal, because it might take 3 years.
Yeah, 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 and then shit could go south. You know?
Take 10.
I mean, shit could go south. True. You know, there's a lot of...
it's projections. When you do the bigger projects, it's projections.
It's projections.
Projection for the fifth year is that you're going to get A, B, and C.
Right.
And if something happened, and I mean, you need to refinance so you can pay your investors all your crowdfunding and all the stuff that you're doing, and you didn't do your numbers right 5 years ago, you know, 5 years later, you're going to eat.
Yeah, fucker. That's why Madoff is in prison.
A lot of
right, huh?
Right? You're Madoff. Whatever you say his name, that's why he's in fucking prison right now. You know, because he didn't, it was just projections and projections and projections. Have you seen that documentary?
I haven't. I haven't.
Dude,
I
remember, which one?
I remember when he was when he got busted, and they were talking about all the shit that he did.
Oh hell yeah!
You gotta create. You gotta hand to the guy. He's pretty creative.
Well, I mean, he got really creative with very many things. And then if you watch the documentary, there are steps where he acknowledges that he knew that it was the wrong step. Okay. Mm. But he couldn't let it go. And he still put all his investors' money at risk. Mm. And then it just went down the drain like that. So they attribute the 2008 crash to a huge part to a lot of his bad decision making.
Oh, wow.
That's how much of an impact it had. It wasn't just, you know, your Wall Street, you know, investor playing with people's money on.
He had a lot of
people. He had a ton of money. Yeah. And watch the documentary. I forget the name of it. We're going to do a sequel on this episode so we can tell you what the name is. But it's badass. It says how much of an impact it had on the American economy that it catapulted the crash of 2008-2009.
Wow.
That's how big it was, you know?
One man.
One man.
Holy shit.
On projections.
That's crazy. That's fucking crazy.
You know? Anyways, a lot of BS tonight. Let's wrap it up.
Lots of coughing, too.
Yeah, dude. Shit. It
wasn't me this time, Sarah.
It was not. You're better.
Okay. Where can people find us, beautiful people?
Oh, yeah. If you guys want to follow us on Instagram, Facebook. You can find us on TikTok. Don't forget to follow us on the Spotify and podcast, and give us that 5-star. That's it.
Couple.
All right, and if you want to know
a little
what we do, how we do it, hit us up at info@becomeaninvestor.com.
Yeah. So I don't know what episode this is, but everybody's a little down today.
I know. Yeah. We started off good, and everybody just got flat. Maybe because it's late. I don't know.
I need the AC to work.
No, sucks. Just Danny had a headache. And
Then she started
sorry, beautiful people.
My ribs started hurting. And, you know.
You're all going to the doctor. Good night.